Another exciting chapter in Isaiah opening before us, and we very much look forward to the words of our brother Brian as he leads us on Isaiah 52, "Awake, awake, O daughter of Zion."
Dear brother Daniel, my dear brothers and sisters, on what is undoubtedly a cold night. Well, our chapter opens with the awakening words. "Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion. Put on thy beautiful garments." Awake, awake is an imperative. It's a double imperative, in fact. And it's the third time that such have been given. Come back to chapter 51, verse 9. "Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of Yahweh." That's an appeal, a rhetorical appeal. It's put that way for its effect. It's an appeal to God, really, isn't it? That God's arm, his strength, his means of doing things will be again seen. But in verse 17, we have the next double imperative, and that's from Yahweh. It's not to him, it's from him. "Awake, awake! Stand up, O Jerusalem! You called upon me? Well, now I'm calling upon you. You asked me to become involved. To stir up the old strength, the old redemption. Well, you be ready for me when I come." And in the previous oracle, we're looking at chapter 52 tonight, and as we know, we're in a series of eight oracles, aren't we? We've discussed that before. But in the previous one, in chapter 51 and verse 17 to 23, it was an oracle that reflected upon the terrifying judgments that were to come upon Israel, which were graphically described as though Jerusalem was a foolish man, a drunken man that couldn't get away from his drink, and his drink was the fury of God. And he drank the dregs of that goblet of divine wrath. "Stand up, O Jerusalem, which hast drunken at the hand of Yahweh the cup of his fury. Thou hast drunken the dregs of the cup of trembling and wrung them out." But the cup of trembling was passing to his oppressors. In verse 22 to 23, that momentous change was indicated. A drunk man, drunk by the continual absorption of the fury of God. But in verse 22 and 23, everything has changed. And the cup passes to Israel's oppressors, and they drink. Those that are oppressed, they now take the cup of trembling. Israel had found no son to give her guidance or to give her comfort. Verse 18. "There is none to guide her among all the sons whom she hath brought forth." There was none who could provide her comfort. These two things, verse 19, "are come unto thee. Who shall be sorry for thee?" Desolation and destruction, and the famine and the sword, matters against property and city, or matters against men or population. "By whom shall I comfort thee?" There wasn't among her sons one who could give the wisdom of guidance or who could provide the comfort that she needed. But you know, in chapter 52, she's got both. She's got wisdom and she's got comfort. She's got guidance and direction. They're all in chapter 52. For example, look at verses 1 and 2. "Awake, awake." This is a new picture. This is an entirely different picture. "Put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garments. O Jerusalem, the holy city, for henceforth there shall no more come unto thee the uncircumcised and the unclean. Shake thyself from the dust, Arise and sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose thyself from the bands of thy neck, O captive daughter of Zion. Isn't that beautiful language? Glorious. Beautiful, moving language. And a total eclipse of everything that we read in the previous oracle. Why are these things mentioned here, my dear brothers and sisters? Why verses 1 and 2? Why are they there? Aren't we building up to a climatic presentation of the divine Saviour? Isn't chapter 52 going to swing the door open as to how God will do this? And it's going to provide us with a picture of a man and of the death which he accomplishes. Then why throw in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 52? What have they got to do with this picture? What they're saying is that that comfort and that guidance that are reflected so beautifully in chapter 52, verse 1 to 2, will never come into being without that which is going to be presented. They're going to happen, but it's not going to be comfort and beauty. It's not going to be the sitting down in royalty. There's not going to be that redemption to a glorious position unless God provides his servant. And so in chapter 52 and verse 13, the crucial note is struck again. Behold, my servant shall do prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Comfort, exaltation, wisdom, prudence, guidance, all there. That's who's coming to do it. And that's why these things are presented to us in this way. They're sort of building up the picture of what's going to be before they've told you how it will be. And there's a certain excitement in that. Isaiah is tantalizingly almost keeping what you're really wanting to know about. He's keeping it, as it were, in his locker until eventually he'll put it right out in the open. But up until that time, he makes us think, he makes us yearn. And the questions come, how? How will this reversal come? This is all very well to give us this dramatic picture of Jerusalem on the one hand seen as a drunken man, stupefied by all of the wrath and terror that's come upon him. And then suddenly he becomes an entirely different thing and he's over his oppressors. How come? How come this? How can that be? Or Jerusalem to put on its holy garments when it was a woman in the dust. How can that possibly be? What has brought the difference? And you do ask those questions, don't you, when you start to really look at the record and think what it's saying. You think, what's it got to do with it? The truth was, it had everything to do with it. Jerusalem will put on her strength and her beautiful garments, but not without the one of chapter 52. My dear brothers and sisters, isn't that a dramatic thing? Because that lesson's still not learned. And isn't it an incredible thing? We're looking at a book that's 700 years before Christ. Isn't that incredibly interesting? Look at our perspective, 2,000 years down the track. And we look back upon that and we say, well, Israel's never appreciated, never seen it. You can hear them talk about even such things as the Holocaust, which must symbolise more than anything else the state of the drunken man with the divine wrath poured into his being in a historic manner. And yet in the midst of that, they could not breathe the name of Jesus Christ. They could not name that they're there because of what they did to God's Son. And it's written in Isaiah 700 years before he came. You know, we are very blessed to have the truth, aren't we? Aren't we blessed? You know, when I read some of these things over the last few days, I felt like standing out on the footpath and yelling to people that they could see the power of God in his word. But they don't want to hear, do they? They couldn't care less. Woe betide us if we lose the thrill of the Word of God. Because it's a very great thing, isn't it? That if we had just 1, 2, 3 chapters in the Bible, they'd be sufficient to tell us that God exists. And that the Bible is the Word of God. Nothing like it is the great anchor of our souls. And gives us confirmation. God said all these things. And when he came, what did they do? Who hath received our report? To whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? The question begged the answer that few would ever understand. And they didn't. It was there in the plainest language. Isaiah built it up and he kept that story back. Just little drops coming out bit by bit. Until eventually he let the whole thing out in chapter 52. Laying there as you ever have it. I still couldn't see it. But you and I see it. Just little you and I. Nobody in the world, eh? And yet God's revealed that to us. And I cannot help but feel a great sense of awe about that. Our responsibilities are very great. I want more than to get through to verse 12 tonight, though it would be nice if we get close. I want us, however, to sense more than that, where we're going just in this 51st and 52nd chapter, because this is very critical. I think it's exceedingly beautiful. I just want us to take a step back and see this sense coming out of the record. You all ready? Now, I've said there's 8 oracles. All right? Do you know where they are? Well, the first 3 began with the word hearken, didn't they? There it was in verse 1. Verses 1 to 3 was the first oracle. Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness. The greatest message ever given about the righteousness of God was going to soon be proclaimed. What an appropriate opening that was. Well, that's the first oracle. The second was also an appeal to listen. Verse 4 to 6. Hearken unto me, my people, and give your ear unto me, O my nation. For a law will go forth, shall proceed from me. And the third is in verse 7 on a kindred note. Hearken unto me, ye that know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my law. So by those 3 compelling statements, God arrests the attention of his people. Here was a promise of salvation. You want to know about righteousness, verse 1? Well, I'm telling you, verse 5, that it's come near. You won't have to go scrambling over the mountains or over the oceans or climb the heavens for it. My righteousness is near. My salvation is gone forth. And he repeats that. It wasn't something that would come and go, but my salvation shall be forever at the end of verse 6. My righteousness shall not be abolished, permanently available. And he repeats that at the end of verse 8. My righteousness shall be forever, and my salvation from generation to generation. Great things are promised in a permanent supply. And it's near. God wants you to have it. Then we have the 3 awakes. Well, we have in verse 17, we have the 7th, and verse 52, chapter 52, verse 1, we have the 2nd, and in chapter 52, verse 11, we have the 3rd. We have the 9th. So we've got the 7th. In chapter 51, verse 17, where God turns to his people and he wants them to awake. And so it's a double imperative. Awake, awake, verse 17. Chapter 52, verse 1, it's God again. Awake, awake. And then chapter 52, verse 11, it's God again. Again, another double imperative. Depart ye, depart ye, go ye out from thence, touch no unclean thing. So a new situation has arisen. And the things that were promised in Songs or Oracles 1, 2 and 3 are in Songs 6, 7 and 8, that's verse 17 to 23, chapter 52 verse 1 to 10, and chapter 52 verse 11 to 12, in those three oracles, the things that were promised have now come to pass. Yahweh has brought a new situation, and they are to awaken to the things that he has brought. So it's 1, 2, 3, and it's 6, 7 and 8. I don't know if I gave that correctly the first time, did I? I didn't. All right. They're coming. I'm glad you asked the question. Right. 4, 5 and 6 are like the chalk for tonight. It's missing. All right, Oracle 1, 51 verse 1 to 3. Oracle 2, verse 4 to 6. Oracle 3, verse 7 and 8. They're the promises that God is setting before them. Thanks, Dan. Oracle 6. I know that he's a maths graduate, but I'm quite aware that between 3 and 6 there are a couple of other numbers. But thanks, Dan. In verse 17, we have number 6. Would you just write down, please, Dan? Verse 17, number 6. And in chapter 52, verse 1 to 10, we have number 7. And in chapter 52, verse 11 to 12, we have number 8. All right? Happy? Now, the two in between are God's assurances that the promises that were given in the first three would be indeed fulfilled. And the fulfillment is in the latter three. That's the sense of this eight oracles and why they come as they do. In other words, those numbers 4 and 5 represent the bridge. The call to the arm of Yahweh to awake in verses 12 to 16, for example, is a beautiful bridge. A bridge of reassurance. It's reflective and meditative. When God says in verses 1 to 8 that he's going to bring those promises, then there's at first a lack of surety as to whether he will do that. Hence verse 9, awake, awake. Yahweh, put on thy strength, O arm of Yahweh. Let us see it as in the days of old. You see, it was one thing to hear the message, but there was not that assurity. And so the bridge is given in verses 9 to 16 in those two oracles that God indeed did intend to fulfill what he said. Verse 12, and that's the fifth of the oracles. I am he that comforteth you. Who art thou that thou shouldest be afraid of a man that shall die, and of the Son of Man which shall be made as grass? Aren't you my people? Aren't you called by a different name? Why then is there among you the tremors and the uncertainties of a people who do not have your God as their God? Who art thou? Beautiful words. Remember that? And forgettest Yahweh thy maker, verse 13. The universal God was their maker. Why should they fear anyone? There is no need, therefore, to hasten. The captive exile hasteneth, verse 14, that he may be loosed. But you don't need to do that. He fears that he should die in the pit, or that his bread should fall. But you don't need to worry about such failure. Nor the fury of the oppressor, verse 13, that God scornfully says, where is the fury of the oppressor? With him it is reduced to a non-issue. He's the same God as old. You ask, verse 19, for him to awake. He will awake. I am Yahweh thy God, verse 15, that divided the sea, whose waves roared. Yahweh of hosts is his name. He is the Yahweh of the Red Sea, of the fame of the deliverance and the beginnings of their nation. And what's more, he intimates the one by whom these things will be done. And verse 16 turns away from the past and looks to the one that's coming, the individual that's coming. I have put my words in thy mouth, and have covered thee in the shadow of mine hand, that I may plant the foundations and lay the foundations of the earth, and say unto Zion, thou art my people. So he's going to be in absolute control through him. So verse 16 narrows and focuses upon the one through whom God will do that. He's given him the equipment. I have put my words in thy mouth. He's given him the divine protection, concealment. I have covered thee in the shadow of mine hand. And he's given him the charter, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth and say unto Zion, thou art my people. Everything is under control. Whether it's the equipment by which it will be done, the protection that will see that he has divine strength on his side, or that he knows what to do, the program has been written, the charter has been declared. And of course, there were in those words, as a background, the words of Moses of old. And they had asked to see an illustration of the arm of Yahweh of ancient days. Well, it was the Moses who took them through that period of time that wrote verse 16 in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 18, where he promised that there would be a prophet that would come like unto him. Chapter 49 had spoken in somewhat similar language. Verse 1, listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far. Yahweh hath called me from the womb, from the bowels of my mother, hath he made mention of my name. There's great divine interest and protection. He hath made my mouth like a sharp sword, put my words in his mouth. Concentration on the development of his mind. Has he been protected and concealed? In the shadow of his hand hath he hid me and made me a polished quiver. So he was protectively concealed until the time came that God would ascend him forth, hid in God's quiver until then. In chapter 50 had opened it up a little bit further to explain the training and development. How would it be that he would have a mouth like a sharp sword? How would it be that Yahweh hath called me from the womb, from the bowels of my mother? In what way would he draw near to him? Well, chapter 50 had those exciting, beautiful, privileged words. The Lord God hath given me the tongue of the learned. My dear princes, can you see the threads running through? Isn't this absolutely glorious? Exceedingly beautiful as bit by bit it's opened up. That I should know how to speak a word in season. I have put my words in thy mouth, he says in 51. That I should know how to speak a word in season. That's how he did it. To him that is weary, he wakeneth morning by morning. More detail. It was a daily instruction, an education from God himself, taught of God, as he will put it in chapter 54. He wakeneth mine ear to hear as the learned. That's how Yahweh was going to put his words in his mouth. And so chapter 51 and verse 16 was in the line of those passages. Extremely beautiful. 51 verse 16 then is about the same one. Well, we are marching forward, aren't we, my dear brothers and sisters? There is, as we sensitively grasp the record, there is a growing excitement because Yahweh is gradually opening the door that we can see it, that which was secret is gradually being revealed about the servant who would be the answer to all of their needs, to all of the things that they personally need, to Zion's needs, to the world's needs. This was not going to be a solution just for Isaiah, nor just for his people, but for all the earth. God was going to provide a solution. But tell me how he's going to do it. We haven't got chapter 53 yet. How is he going to do it? And that is their begging, isn't it? It's the question that we're all asking. And any sensitive reader of Isaiah would have felt, but how? That was an exciting and remarkable thing he said this day. But how will that happen? What will he do with this one that he's going to provide? That he's going to educate? What will he do? How will he bring those blessings? How will he change the system from that which came by Moses to this new system of the prophet like unto Moses? Well, that's all waiting, you see, to chapter 52. And verses 13 of chapter 52 to chapter 53. Those 15 verses, they will tell the theme. And so we come then to chapter 51 as he's presenting to them the drama of this colossal change. Chapter 51 verse 17, the drunken man, intoxicated by divine wrath. My dear brothers and sisters, that was a story that needed to be put in the record, wasn't it? What an incredible truth that has proven to be. Where was that going to fit into the story? It was of a people who were gone into captivity, that were in fear of the oppressor, verse 13. None of his sons could avoid this, verse 18. None could take away the cup. And these things came, but there was no comfort, verse 19. Her sons fainted, verse 20. They lie at the head of all the streets as a wild bull in a net. They're full of the fury of Yahweh, the rebuke of thy God. What an amazing statement that was. It had to be put into the story, didn't it? Zion's end would never be accomplished until that would come. And so before we get the solution, God tells them the drama of the things that are going to come. And who would be the answer to that? The one in chapter 52 and 53. He would be the answer to that. And that's a secret that still lies unearthed in Israel today. Phenomenal change from the drunken person to the king prince, really. If you look at chapter 52, verse 1 and 2, you've really got a statehood of a royal priesthood sitting down in set royalty with beautiful garments as of a priest. Phenomenal change from verse 17 of chapter 51. How would all of these things come to pass? Why would this great change take place? These glorious reversals? Well, nothing is answered until, behold my servant. So, in summary, chapter 51 verses 1 to 7, or 1 to 8, there was a series of glorious promises eternal, satisfying answers to the needs of mankind. In chapter 51, verse 17, to chapter 52, verse 12, the divine commands, awake, awake, were showing that those needs would be met. The promises would be fulfilled in beautiful restorations, in exciting reversals, in wonderful blessings towards the nation. So let's have a look now at chapter 52 and see where this one is going. We gather from chapter 52 verse 1 that very good things are being promised to Jerusalem. Something similar had been indicated in chapter 51 verse 3. Yahweh shall comfort Zion. There was none to comfort in 51 verse 19, but he said he will comfort. Yahweh shall comfort. He will comfort all her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of Yahweh. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. So in chapter 52, he's developing then that which was promised in the earlier statement. He says, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garments. There's a sense there in which the strength and the beautiful garments truly belong to Zion. Jerusalem should be like that. There was an appropriateness of Jerusalem or Zion to be like that. They were her strength and her beautiful garments. And that's true, isn't it? The voice of all the prophets indicated that there was to be a royal dignity about that city. A holiness. Verse 1, the holy city. There was to be a holiness about that city. Well, such is the strength of the statements, but how would that be brought about? Well, verse 3 says, or verse 2 says, shake thyself from the dust. Arise and sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose thyself from the bands of thy neck, O captive daughter of Zion. So this is the captive daughter of the previous chapter, isn't it? Verse 14 spoke about the captives and spoke about the one who was oppressed in verses 17 to 23. So a tremendous reversal is going to take place in her circumstances, but it's not revealed as to how that yet will take place. Well, let's take now some of the details of the prophecy. Beautiful garments is an expression that really belongs to Exodus chapter 28. Let's come back to Exodus chapter 28 and we'll find that the same language is here used in Exodus chapter 28 verse 2 of the high priests and the garments that he was appointed to. Take thou unto thee Aaron thy brother and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office. Verse 2, and thou shalt make holy garments for Aaron thy brother for glory and for beauty. And there the same language is used that we have in Isaiah 52 and verse 1. For the word is not beautiful garments, but garments of beauty, and borrowing in the sense of Exodus chapter 28 and verse 2. And you'll notice that, again, we have the emphasis of God in 52 verse 1, that he really wants this to happen. He's saying to the people, look, awake, awake. Rouse up, I want this to happen. Put on thy strength, put on thy beautiful garments. There's a very real sense of divine desire of these things. He's stressing that this is what he wants to see happen. Here was a woman who thought everything was finished. She was in a drunken stupor, but she awakes to find, in fact, that the garments are laid, as it were, like one might prepare the garments for another. And they're all laid out and ready for her. And God is the one that has gone before and prepared the garments for the time of her redemption. Everything was in control. In verse 2, for example, it says words that really imply that she comes from the dust to be established in royalty. Shake thyself from the dust, arise and sit down, O Jerusalem, daughter of Zion. And when she sits down, my dear friends, she's not sitting down in a chair, is she? She's sitting down in a throne. That's what Jerusalem is, a capital city. It is the city of royalty. So when you put the two things together, verse 1 and verse 2, you can see that what is really being presented is a fulfillment of what was originally promised to her. If we come back to Exodus chapter 19, there was a promise that had been given, but never really realized. In Exodus 19, it says there about the peculiar treasure above all people. It says in verse 6 that ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. A kingdom of priests and an holy nation. And that's what's being presented here. At last, that original goal presented by Yahweh would be fulfilled in his people. But Yahweh has first substantiated his righteousness. In the bracket that went before, verses 17 to 23 of chapter 51, there was this terrible story about their exile. Before the glory, there would be the judgment. Nobody could ever say, when Israel was redeemed in the future and seen in her glory, that God just handed it out on a plate. Before the beautiful garments, there was the trials of history. And by that exile that is so powerfully illustrated in the previous verses, so it was made right that she should eventually come into her glory. He had substantiated his righteousness with them. Now, those words, just by the way, in Isaiah 51 about her exile and about her oppressors, really evoke the final words of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 28. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 28. There is no passage that is so much behind those words as this one. You know how it spoke about, thou hast speared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor, verse 13. Thou hast speared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor, as if he were ready to destroy. The captive exile hasteneth that he may be loosed. Thy sons have fainted, they lie at the head of the streets. None to guide, none to comfort, desolation and destruction. Well, all of that is Deuteronomy chapter 28, and particularly the last few verses. Yahweh shall scatter thee among all people, from the one end of the earth even unto the other, Deuteronomy 28 verse 64. And there shalt thou serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. But Yahweh shall give thee a trembling heart and failing of eyes and sorrow of mind. And thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shall have none assurance of thy life. It's the very sentiments of Isaiah 51, isn't it? In the morning thou shalt say, would God it were even. And at even thou shalt say, would God it were morning. For the fear of thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes which thou shalt see. That's the background, I am sure, to those words in chapter 51. But that now having passed, Jerusalem is depicted as the holy city. The time has come for her to enter into her better and more beautiful days. And it says that she has garments of beauty. You just hold your hand in 52 and come back to chapter 4 of Isaiah. You'll see that there's a beautiful sense in which those words are true. True in absolute truth. In Isaiah 4 and verse 2 it says, "In that day shall the branch of Yahweh," and we know who that is, it's the Lord Jesus Christ, "the branch of Yahweh, be beautiful and glorious." And there's the twin words straight out of Exodus 28 verse 2. Glory and beauty. In other words, this is playing upon that which was said to Aaron and his sons. But with Aaron and his sons, it was sometimes just the garments that were of beauty and of glory. Two of those four sons that were spoken to in that 28th chapter were Nadab and Abihu, wretched louts. And God destroyed them. They wore the garment, but inside there was not the beauty and the glory that God wanted. You know, it's an interesting thing that people speak about even today in terms of priesthood, that they have a certain habit. And what do they mean by that? They don't actually mean the way the person lives, do they? They mean what he puts on. So if it's a Franciscan monk, then he has a certain habit, that is, he dresses in a certain way. What God is here saying is that this new priest doesn't have something that he puts on. He is beauty and glory, which of course was what was really meant when it said to Aaron that he should put on those garments. And consequently, because of the branch of Yahweh being of beauty and of glory, then the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. His influence will go abroad because he is what his garments suggest, or what Aaron's garments originally suggested. This is a moral habit. It is not something that is just put on. And so the same thing is implied in chapter 52, verse 1, when Zion puts on her beautiful garments and she becomes the holy city. It's interesting in chapter 48 and verse 2, that there they call themselves of the holy city and stay themselves upon the God of Israel. But in actual fact, it was a fraudulent claim, wasn't it? Because they did not fulfill the terms of a holy city. But in chapter 52, verse 1, they will. This new garment will be something that is not just on the outside, so to speak. It will be the city, it will be the people, it will be the king, it will be the priests of that same city. And that's interesting too, because if we come back into chapter 50 and 51, we had echoes of a garment here, didn't we? This then is playing upon the former statements. The former statements in chapter 50, verse 9. "Behold, the Lord God will help me. Who is he that shall condemn me? Lo, they all shall wax old as a garment. The moth shall eat them up." Verse 6, midway through, "The heavens shall vanish away like smoke, and the earth shall wax old like a garment." Not the literal earth, but the mosaic constitution of things that were established in the days when Jesus was there, their temple and all of their service. Or verse 8, "For the moth shall eat them up like a garment." That old Jerusalem's ready to go. It was old and ready to pass away, but the new was ready to stand out in its beauty in the day when it would be truly all that Jerusalem ever should have been. The better will have come, and so it will take precedence. And it says furthermore, in keeping with this being a holy city, that it shall henceforth rather, there shall be no more come into thee the uncircumcised and the unclean. Do you remember chapter 35? Had a very similar statement to that. In chapter 35, it said in verse 8, and a highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness that leads to the holy city. The unclean shall not pass over it. There's no path for them to that city. In Zechariah 14, too, he has the same sense in the last two verses of Zechariah 14. Verse 20. In that day shall there be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto Yahweh. And the pots in Yahweh's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto Yahweh of hosts. Every pot. Really speaking about pots? Got interested in pots that have got holiness written. It's talking about vessels, isn't it? It's really speaking about men and women in its ultimate. And they are holiness unto Yahweh. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and see therein. And in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of Yahweh of hosts. No more come unto thee the uncircumcised and the unclean, says Isaiah. Not uncircumcised as of the flesh, but the uncircumcision that Moses spoke of in, if you like, the little reference in Deuteronomy 10, verse 16, where he spoke about them being uncircumcised of heart. And Jeremiah picked up the same phrase too in his 9th chapter. In Jeremiah 9, the same sense is given where he says in verse 25, "Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will punish all them which are circumcised with the uncircumcision. For all these nations are uncircumcised, and all the house of Israel are uncircumcised in the heart." Verse 26 at the end of that verse. So it's not speaking of their physical situation, it's speaking about their mental attitude. They are holy people for a holy city. And whereas they had prided themselves fraudulently upon that in the past, now have come to pass in reality. And then this beautiful woman is seen rising out of the dust. Remember in chapter 51, verse 23, it says, "And thou hast laid thy body as the ground and as the street." So verse 2, picking up that sense, "Shake thyself from the dust of the ground or of the street and all of its dejection. Shake thyself from that and arise and sit down, O Jerusalem." As I said, that's not some kind of chair, is it? It's a throne, because this is a royal city. And so we have this beautiful concept of a royal priesthood, a priesthood in verse 1, of a royalty in verse 2. Very beautiful reference in Psalm 113. Very beautiful reference, which says that this is God's delight to do just this. He raiseth up, verse 7, "He raiseth up the poor out of the dust and lifteth the needy out of the dunghill, that he may set him with princes, even with the princes of his people. He maketh the barren woman to keep house." And that's what Israel had become. So there was this wonderful invitation for her to break forth, that was captive, to break forth into new freedom. In chapter 49, it had referred to her as being in prison or in captivity. In chapter 49, verse 9, thou mayest say to the prisoners, go forth; to them that are in darkness, show yourselves. Or verse 25, but thus saith Yahweh, even the captives of the mighty shall be taken away, and the prey of the terrible shall be delivered. So great will be the deliverance God will provide, that never mind who the oppressor was, his people will be brought back to him. In chapter 51 and verse 14, you have a reference there again about the captive exile. Verse 14, the captive exile hasteneth that he may be loosed. And so now all of that's flowing into this little verse here in verse 2. Loose thyself from the bands of thy neck, O captive daughter of Zion. The captive daughter of Zion with bands about her neck is similar to what was done with the oxen, where they put the yoke upon the oxen's neck, and it was used as a bond slave, in effect. And that oxen had to just simply do whatever the master wanted it to do. And you know, that really is a graphic description of what has happened to Israel over the years. God saying, snap those bands off, take off the yoke, and arise to your liberty. I was only reading just in the last week or two about the early days of Auschwitz. You know, Auschwitz was a camp, originally as a transit camp. When Germany took Poland, they needed many, many labourers in Germany, more than they had as German men, because German men were all out on the front and doing all sorts of things. So they wanted some slave labour, so they collected tens of thousands of people in Poland, and tens of thousands of Jews, and they carted them into Germany and put them alongside factories. The very early camps were just for that purpose. So you had, you know, Dachau and Buchenwald and these other early ones. And they were always alongside industrial sites or mines. And that's exactly what they did. They were just used like oxen, just carted off from this transit camp that later became a huge monolithic institution of destruction of the same people. This, my dear brothers and sisters, is pretty grand language, isn't it? Shake thyself from the dust. Arise and sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose thyself from the bands of thy neck, O captive daughter of Zion. And it's God that says, awake, awake to that. Don't you think I've got things under control? Indeed he did. A beautiful contrast indeed with that which had gone before. Just by way of contrast too, have a look at chapter 47 and verse 1. When this woman sits in her royal and holy beauty, Babylon will be sitting in the dust. 47 verse 1. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground. There is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate. Isn't that interesting? Beautiful contrast in chapter 52 with Zion. Well, how can God do those things? What was the answer to this enormous restoration, this tremendous change from what had been? 4 verse 3 in the next little bracket. For thus saith Yahweh. And the theme of the next few verses, the reason for this tremendous change, is God's redemption. He's going to redeem them. They can't be like verses 1 and 2 unless he does. So 4 at the beginning of verse 3 connects with those words. For thus saith Yahweh, ye have sold yourselves for naught, and ye shall be redeemed without money. There's the answer. That's what I'm going to do. And Israel have sold themselves for naught. It's very interesting just to go back to those words of Deuteronomy chapter 28, which I said to you were a real background to that captivity section. Have a look at Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 68. The last verse of Deuteronomy 28, Yahweh shall bring thee into Egypt again with ships by the way whereof I spake unto thee. Thou shalt see it no more again. And there ye shall be sold unto your enemies for bondmen and bondwomen with those yokes upon them. And no man shall buy you. You'll be a giveaway price. You know, that actually happened in AD 70. There were so many captives that came from Jerusalem, from Judea, that the price of slaves just zeroed. You could get them for tuppence. And it was true, as the prophet said, that you have sold yourselves for naught. They weren't worth anything. As we were saying just a little moment ago, that the use of labour in Europe during those terrible years of World War II illustrated how powerfully true this was. Ye have sold yourselves for naught. Now, when you are sold, when you sell yourself, the sense of that is that you seek to obtain something by virtue of your own self. Your trading is involved in the sense of it, isn't it? You know, that's really what Israel tried to do, what the Jews tried to do in Germany. They tried to sell themselves for something. They said that if we go along with Germany, and if we make ourselves good German citizens, and that was the term, then we will be useful to the German nation. There will be fruits that we will get out of that for ourselves. A bit like Ahaz of old, who said, well, if Syria is going to be joined to the northern kingdom, then we'll make a compact with Assyria. And so he did. But it didn't help him one whit, did it? He sold himself to Assyria, but he got no fruits out of it. And neither did the Jews through the years. They changed their names. They did everything they could to try and conceal themselves. But in the end, it was frustration. And they died in thousands and the millions. Terrible things, but how dramatic it is. Well, then God says, you've sold yourself for naught. You shall be redeemed without money. God was not going to be paying silver. The word money is the word silver. You shall be redeemed without silver. Well, silver was the coinage of redemption, wasn't it? Under the law in Exodus 30, there was the silver coin that bought redemption. Redemption in the Old Testament sense was always this concept of a money transaction. That's behind the very word ransom. When a person is ransomed, he was redeemed. It was the same word in the Hebrew. And the concept was that you gave this and you got that. It might be your prince or your king that's taken captive. So you paid a price to get him back. You redeemed him. You ransomed him from the opposition. Israel were ransomed out of Egypt, it says in Exodus 15. He's ransomed people. He paid a price for them. That is to say, the firstborn of Egypt were paid that Israel might come out of that country. In chapter 35, it speaks about the ransomed of Israel, ransomed of the Lord, doesn't it? And the ransomed of Yahweh shall return. The same sense is given there. Well, if he's not going to redeem them with silver, what is he going to redeem them with? How's he make the payment? And again, Isaiah tantalizingly doesn't tell us the full story. But he goes on to say, you can rest assured that I will do it. The evidence of history is in that direction. Verse 4, it mentions two times in which God had evidence, his utter determination to save his people. For thus saith the Lord Yahweh. You think that I'll do this? For thus saith the Lord Yahweh. My people went down aforetime into Egypt to sojourn there. And the Assyrian oppressed them without cause. Now, they're not two statements like joined together in one sense or joined together as happenings. They're separated, aren't they? One, in fact, happened at the beginning of the nation when they went into Egypt. The other one has only happened in recent history. It's happened within the lifetime of Isaiah and Hezekiah. You might say it's the A and the Z of the nation's history. The beginning and the end tell the story of whether God will redeem his people. My people went down aforetime into Egypt to sojourn there. The rest of the story is not given. What happened down there? Well, they were invited to go. Pharaoh said, come. He wanted them to come. In Genesis chapter 45, verses 16 to 20, it says how that he said to the sons of Jacob, you go back and you get your father and you bring him down and we will look after him. They wanted them to come down. They came down. They did well. And Egypt then turned against them. And the implication is, well, what did God do? Did he say, oh, that's bad luck. Can't do anything about that. You're in Egypt now. He didn't do that. In Exodus chapter 2, it says that God saw what happened down there. And it grieved him of what he saw. In Exodus chapter 2, in the end of that chapter, it says, and God heard their groaning. Verse 24 of Exodus 2, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. Or chapter 3 in verse 7, Yahweh said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people, my people. And that's our phrase, isn't it? That my people is taken away for naught. My people went down before time into Egypt, verse 4 of Isaiah. I have surely seen the affliction of my people. He's next of kin. You speak about your people, don't you? You mean your close relatives. That's your people. Well, God's close relatives is Israel. I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So God would not go past that which he had promised. And he surely delivered them. And so all of that story is behind chapter 52 and verse 4, although it's not sketched out. For thus saith the Lord Yahweh, my people went down aforetime into Egypt to sojourn there. And then the next little phrase is, and the Assyrian oppressed them without cause. Now that was, as we said, in recent history, chapter 37 of Isaiah. What did he do on that occasion? Well, of course, he drowned Egypt in the Red Sea. In chapter 37 and verse 36 of Isaiah, this is what happened to the Assyrians. The Assyrians who oppressed them without cause. The angel of Yahweh went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. The Red Sea and its pathway through scattered with the remains of the Egyptian army. Pharaoh and all of his pomp and glory buried in the sea. Egypt laying as a dead corpse, 185,000 people. Did God need any further evidence of what he would do for his people? And we emphasize his people because if you come down to verse 5, you'll see that he repeats it again. Verse 4, my people. Verse 5, my people. Verse 6, my people. See that? Link those three together because it increases the sense of what God is saying through these verses. Now therefore, what have I here, saith Yahweh, that my people is taken away for naught? That is to say, does this move me? What role have I got in this? How does it affect me? They that rule over them make them to hell, saith Yahweh, and my name continually every day is blasphemed. In other words, he will be involved What has he here? He has a lot involved because of my people and because of my name. Those two things. He's got stakes in the issue of his people because of those two things. And if they're going to go into the Gentiles and they're going to be ruled over to the extent that Israel will howl because of the oppressions, then God will remember because they are my people and because it is my name that is upon them. See the point of that in verse 5? Very, very beautiful. What therefore have I here? That's what I've got. My stakes are my people and my name. Therefore, my people, verse 6, shall know my name. Not that they'll be able to pronounce it in that sense, my dear brothers and sisters, but they will see what it really means. Now, what did that name really mean? If you come back to Exodus chapter 6, there is the best exposition of that name given by God himself. In Exodus chapter 6 and verse 6, having said that he would now be known by his name of Yahweh, he says this in verse 6, "Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am Yahweh." It says it there, it says it in the middle of verse 7, and it says it at the end of verse 8. What's bracketed between verse 6 and the end of verse 8 is a statement of what Yahweh means. What does Yahweh mean? Here it is. I will bring you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. And I will rid you out of their bondage. And I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments. And I will take you to me for a people. And I will be to you a God. And ye shall know that I am Yahweh your God, which bringeth you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land concerning the which I did swear to give it to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And I will give it to you for an heritage. I am Yahweh. In a word, Yahweh is a redeeming God. A faithful, redeeming God. And that's what he means when he says in chapter 52, verse 6, "Therefore my people shall know my name." They will come to realize it when they see it enacted. "Therefore they shall know," verse 6, "in that day that I am he that doth speak. Behold, behold me, it is I." How will God do that? How would he speak to them? How would he show that it is him? Again, the hows and the whys were not given. It's going to be amplified in the subsequent chapters. Now, I'm just going to run through the sense, just so you feel the final thrill of this little section. The sense of this message. In verse 7, he says, "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation." It's about a message and a messenger that's coming with the best things, the very best news you could want. And because of that, even his feet are beautiful because of the things, the glory of the message he brings. Good tidings, peace. Good and salvation, all the things that we desperately want. And he comes to Zion as a messenger and says, "Thy God reigneth." That's why it says in verse 6, "It is I." In a special way, God's coming to his people as he's never come before. It will be a manifestation of him they've never seen before. And so the messenger, it comes to the city, hastening, running to the city with joy in his heart to announce good tidings of peace and of good and of salvation. And coming behind him is his God that will reign. And the watchmen upon the city, they see the messenger come, they pick up the strains of his argument. They're exultant. Every one of them's exultant. They lift up the voice. With a voice together shall they sing. It's a unified concert. For they shall see eye to eye when Yahweh shall bring again Zion. There's a new spark of life and hope in this city. Every man is together. They shall see eye to eye. And they're rejoicing as a group of watchmen. Around the walls goes the message. As one watchman calls out to another, to another, to another. And till the city is ringing with the noise. And the whole city then erupts into praise. As do the places around her. The countryside is affected. Break forth into joy. Sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem. The whole countryside of Judah is erupted in praise of that which has come. What's come? For Yahweh hath comforted his people. He hath redeemed Jerusalem. Yes, but how and through whom? How is it that he comes to them? What does it mean, thy God reigneth? How will that happen? Yahweh hath made, verse 10, Yahweh hath made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations. Universal salvation. Not Jerusalem, an island of holiness in a world of Gentile iniquity and ignorance. But Yahweh hath provided for all men. Made his arm bare in the eyes of all the nations. And all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. And so there's a call for us to make an exodus. Not like the old deliverance, where they gird up the loins of their garments and they left Egypt in haste. This will be a different exodus. Depart ye, go ye out from thence, touch no unclean thing. Go ye out of the midst of her, be ye clean, that bear the vessels of Yahweh. They will go with dignified precision and order. For ye shall not go out with haste as you did from Egypt before, nor go by flight. For Yahweh will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rearward. And you keep on asking yourselves the question, if you're in Isaiah's day, but how? Who? By whom? Why does God say those things? How will he bring it to pass? And that's Isaiah's wonderful way of delivering the message. He intrigues us with the questions as to how God will do that. And you and I know the answer because we've got the next chapter there. But wasn't it a wonderful way to deliver the message? And the people that listened sensitively to Isaiah's message and could see that something just magnificent was going to happen for Jerusalem. The whole city would be ringing with delight as good and salvation and glad tidings was coming to the city. They must have wondered, what did God mean by that? You know, in the next chapter, he presents one who dies to take away the sins of mankind. It was the ingredient they couldn't see, they had a need of. And the marvellous thing is, my dear brothers and sisters, juries still can't see that. You and I can. Because we've come to realise what must come first. God must be vindicated first. Our sins must be taken away. There must be a recognition of the righteousness of God. And then all the good things can follow, the good and the salvation and the glad tidings. A messenger came first to Jerusalem in days of old, but it's going to be far greater in the future, isn't it? And there's a double application of that prophecy. A redeemer shall come to Zion and turn ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant with them, when I shall take away their sins. So it's had a part fulfillment. We'll have a greater fulfillment in the days to come. Thank you.